I noticed, like, when I play, you know, in a tiny bar or something, or when I, you know, I played at Madison Square Garden, in some way it's the same thing. It's like you get into this zone of playing that you don't really, you know, you don't really see how massive or how small the place is. It's just like you're just making music, so, you know, it just becomes the same thing to me. Although it's like really, it's fun to do those big gigs, you know, because they come with nice perks and stuff like that. But it's really, at some point, it's just kind of the same thing.
I would say it's still pretty vibrant. You know, jazz in general is really celebrated here. That was one of the things that really surprised me when I first started coming over here. It's really, I recently did like a television show where they were celebrating the top jazz artists in France and giving it awards, kind of like the Jazz Grammys or something. You know, so it's just like, it's part of the culture.
Hi, you're listening to Conversations with Musicians with Leah Roseman, which I hope inspires you through the personal stories of a fascinating diversity of musical guests. Rachel Eckroth and John Hadfield are wonderfully inventive musicians who have formed a duo. This podcast episode is shining a light on their recently released album, Speaking in Tongues, and you'll hear some of this textured and dynamic music that really pushes the boundaries of a duo, along with insights into their creative process and their varied career paths. John Hadfield is a phenomenal percussionist, drummer, and composer, for many years based in New York and now based in Paris. He's collaborated on over 100 recordings, including Grammy Award-winning albums. He talked to me about performing with Kenny Werner, with Yo-Yo Ma and the Silk Road Ensemble, as well as John's Paris Quartet. Rachel Eckroth was nominated for a Grammy for her album The Garden, and she's very active as a keyboardist, vocalist, composer, producer, and arranger. She tours currently with St. Vincent, and she talked to me about her keyboards and some of her formative experiences. Both Rachel and John love to explore new sound colors, both acoustically and with electronic instruments, and this album is a powerful, inventive, and immersive listening experience. You'll find this project linked in the show notes, and hopefully some of you can attend their live shows on one of their tours. Like all my episodes, you can watch this on my YouTube channel or listen to the podcast on all the podcast platforms, and I've also linked the transcript to my website, leahroseman.com. It's a joy to bring these inspiring episodes to you every week, and I do all the many jobs of research, production, and publicity. Have a look at the description of this episode, where you'll find all the links, including timestamps and different ways to support this podcast. Hey, Rachel and John, thanks so much for joining me here today.
Thank you.
It is cool because we're across these very different time zones. We were just talking about that, and that always gives me it's especially delightful.
Yeah, John and I are pretty much always opposite, across the world from each other.
Yeah. Today we're going to be mostly celebrating your fantastic new album, Speaking in Tongues, which was just released, and because I got a preview copy, I've been really enjoying listening to it. So thanks for this great music.
Thank you.
And I want to talk about the album. We're going to be including some clips from some tracks, and I also want to get to know each of you as musicians. So we're just going to kind of take turns asking you questions and also talking about the album and some of your own projects, if that's cool.
Sure.
So the title track, John, this is your composition, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I mean, it's my composition, but Rachel works her magic on it. So.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's an open sort of... As far as the composition goes, just a lead sheet, and we improvise on it. It, like a lot of my compositions, it's kind of based off of a rhythmic puzzle or a little game, and it's a lot of fun to play. And I think that's the key. I really wanted a piece that was a lot of fun to play, and since we've been playing live, it's a lot of fun to play it live as well, and completely different than the album, but yeah, so I'm happy with the way it turned out.
Yeah, I was wondering, with you guys playing this material live, it sounds a lot of it's very improvised and there's a lot of layers and different elements. So when you made the album, were you together or was it remote?
We were together. Well, we started it together. We recorded in Greece. So in Athens, we went into a studio and we laid down basically acoustic piano and drums percussion setup. So that was for a lot of it. Actually, I think it was for every track. We did every track that way to start. And then we ended up overdubbing a lot of stuff remotely and some of it together. And that's how it all formed. But the original idea was just, you know, in the studio, piano and drums, but it kind of became a whole other thing later on.
Yeah. So, and John, do you want to just speak to the name, the title?
Yeah, okay, yeah. We always have this, like, we kind of have this, I don't know. Well, actually, the first track that Rachel brought is the Jesus side. So there was always this kind of like religious reference, and there's no direct religious reference. It just seemed to be more of a theme. And so I'm originally from Missouri. And so when I think of the sort of like the religion that is present where I am from, it is more of like this Pentecostal, you know, speaking in tongues, otherworldly aspect of things. And honestly, that's an aspect that I find very interesting. I also really enjoy the otherworldly. And I also kind of like draw a comparison between that and the art of improvisation, and the fact that lots of times it's really kind of hard to articulate what are we doing? You know, how am I, in an ideal world, how am I improvising? And so I just kind of made that connection, and that's why we landed on that title. Also, I played it in Paris a little bit, like at jam sessions, like we do a lot of the time. And everybody here thought the title was so bizarre and so interesting because they couldn't really, just because it's like it's like kind of like lost in translation, that it gave it a little more weight and made it seem even more appropriate. So that's kind of how it settled on it.
Do you translate directly into French? Like parlons en
langue? No. I just say something.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I understand you use kind of a cool hybrid drum kit percussion, and you're, of course, you also are into electronics. So how does that work live, your setup?
Yeah, so that's exactly how, like, for this particular track, I have, like, an electronic drum sampler pad where I trigger the bass sound that you hear. Mm-hmm. And actually, I even trigger some of the other keyboard sounds that Rachel played just because I had the files from the session, and so I just sampled them. And so I just triggered them. It's a little more open, but... yeah, I mean, that's just kind of a reflection of all the things that I'm interested in. I'm interested in electronics, I'm electronic music, I'm interested in percussion. I had like a long period of time where I just primarily only played percussion. So it's like I incorporate all of this, and that's just kind of become my sound.
Yeah.
You're about to hear an excerpt from the title track from this album, Speaking in Tongues. You'll find the album linked directly in the show notes.
Phase and Libration, Part 1. That wasn't a mistyping, right? It's Libration, not Liberation.
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah. So there's these cool ostinato chimes that kind of reminded me of gamelan sounds.
Oh, yeah. Actually, so speaking of percussion, that's right. Those are called gamelan strips.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah. So good good ears. So, but it's this. That's the an instrument maker actually in Colorado who makes them. I went to their house, honestly, in like suburbia Fort Collins, Colorado, really exotic, and in their garage they're making them. I told them which pitches I wanted, and I came back like a couple hours later and they were done. I actually spent some time in Indonesia studying gamelan music though, so that's kind of why I was really drawn towards that sound. And as well, it's really easy to play because I just lay those on like a soft like egg foam, like just a piece of foam, and then play it. As opposed to a gamelan instrument, it's quite a bit to actually bring.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's so, very interesting.
Thank you.
So when was that time in Indonesia?
That was a long time ago. That was like when I graduated, 2000. It was like the summer of 2001. I graduated from conservatory, and I was like, I cannot read music for like 2 months or something. I want to learn some music that I just wanted to, you know, be pushed and expanded and just go into a situation where I knew nothing and try to decipher what was happening.
What was that experience like?
Yeah, I mean, that was a crazy experience. I went there for 2 months. There was upheaval in Jakarta at the time. Their currency plummeted. You know, I would literally just hang out, and I had a friend who had a Fulbright during that time period, and so he connected me with a bunch of people, and I stayed like in the jungle and took one or two lessons per day, practiced, transcribed what I was doing, and swam in waterfalls, you know, something like that. Yeah.
Wow, I'm glad I asked about that.
It was good.
This is Phase and Libration, Part 1.
So did you guys meet at the University of Nevada?
That's right, yeah.
I was trying to figure out the connection, and I was looking at your bios, and I was like, University of Nevada? University of Nevada, okay.
It was years ago. Yeah. I mean, a lifetime ago. It's crazy how time flies, but that was in 1996 that we met. Mm-hmm.
So is this your first major project together?
I think so.
Yeah. I mean, other than my senior recital, yes. And I can only convince her to play on like one tune. But yeah, this is.
I mean, we reconnected just playing a gig with a French saxophonist about 2 years ago. So. So we both lived in New York at the same time, and like, you know, our paths were like this. I didn't really see John that much, but, you know, aware of what he was doing. And then he, reached out to get me on this tour in France and a record. So that's how we decided to come up with this project.
And John, you're still based in New York, but you spend time in Paris. Is that right?
No, I'm more like based in Paris, but I go to New York. I'm going to New York on Sunday. I have a real like sort of back and forth existence right now.
Okay. So Rachel, you came from this musical family. In fact, your brother's a jazz pianist too, right? So what was that like growing up?
Let's see. Well, my dad, when I was really young, he was a band director, and John has a similar story actually.
Yeah, my dad's a band director as well.
But that was. His side of the family, like a lot of his brothers were doing that, band director, orchestra. And so it was just sort of a thing. We were always around music. So you know, growing up, there's four kids in my family. We all took piano lessons. We all played other instruments in band and stuff like that. And I don't know, it was a regular, you know, suburban upbringing. Once my brother, he's a year older than me, once we both started getting better and into jazz, then it became like pretty competitive at that time because we both play the same instrument and, you know, one piano and, you know, a lot of times as a pianist, if you're, you know, we went to the same schools actually as well at college. And so there was always like a little bit of competition trying to, you know, he was a year older, so he was always in the top band and, you know, I had to fight him for positions. But I mean, it was it was great. I really, you know, kind of enjoyed growing up in a music family because it was something different from, you know, the kids around me at school. It was just like I had this thing that I do, and you know, not a lot of kids were doing arts and stuff like that. So yeah.
Do you think it made it more viable career option because you could see different ways to be a musician?
Yeah, absolutely. When I was, about five, my parents were in a country band together. So we lived in Montana and they did like a little tour at some point with their band and we went around and you know, we were super young. There were three of us at the time, but we stayed like in a motel and they would take us to sound check, which would be like a bar, you know. And so just to see them up on stage and we'd be sitting in this place that we're not allowed in, it was just kind of like cool and different. And I got to see what it's like to be a musician, I guess, or like be a working musician.
Yeah. So many people I've interviewed, especially in the jazz world, there was like this idea that you have to go to school like Berklee, or they got in, but they couldn't afford it, the sort of thing. And there's these ideas of the top schools, but there's so many fantastic programs and mentors all around. What would you guys say about your experience at University of Nevada?
Yeah, my experience was really positive. We both had very nice scholarships too, honestly, and they were supportive financially. And I have a feeling that because of that, both of our sort of departments, me more of in percussion land, and Rachel and Jasmine, it was a priority of the school. And so I felt supported and I felt like it was a good environment during that time. I'm sure it probably still is, but yeah.
Well, same thing for me. It was like, I went there, we actually showed up, I think similar time. Maybe you were there a little bit before me, you know, and I had a scholarship and I felt like I got a lot of opportunities that, I might not have gotten at a really competitive school or something like that. So, and not to mention we were in Vegas. So, you know, I was able to like actually work professionally while I was in school, you know, a lot of the nights. So it was a really good, formative time.
Are there things you wish you'd known then as like a young woman working, like starting
like
to
being a woman? I mean, yeah, but I think it's the same stuff that most women in the world go through. you know, just how to like stand up for yourself and stuff like that. But yeah, besides that, I wish I would have learned how to save money. So, yeah.
Okay, let's talk about God Particle, the first track on your album. Is that a reference to the book?
It's a reference to the particle. I think it's called the Higgs boson particle. What it is. It's just, it was just kind of another, like, reference to creation, you know, religion, like where, what's happening, where did we come from, what's going on, you know, and I guess when I heard about this God particle, like, I don't know, 10 years ago, I was just like, what, how can you even find like the most, you know, minute particle? I think that's what it is. It's like the creation particle or something like that. It's like, anyway, it was a really interesting thing to find out in my lifetime. And so like that just stuck with me, like the, oh, God particle is like really cool thing. And so we actually recorded that song. We said, you know, I told John, just play, you know, let's just play something, you start it. And so he just tracked in the studio with, we didn't really have a song yet. So we just tracked drums and then took it home and made the song after the fact based on what he played.
Yeah, that was like the last day of the recording. The last day of the recording, we did 3 days in Athens. Yeah, we were just recording stuff. We just recorded drums. Yeah, and then built the song after the fact. Because Rachel had like a really extensive synthesizer.
Yeah, I have a pretty nice setup to create. But you know, it's I guess in a funny way, it's like, you know, that was the starting point, which is like the God particle is the starting point. The drum track was the starting point for that track. So, but yeah, I think what happened was we just came up with some chord changes and then just started building from there.
You're about to hear a clip from God Particle from the album Speaking in Tongues.
So Rachel, I really, really enjoyed your solo album One, which came out last year. Really, really beautiful. And I was hoping if you're willing, it might be nice to include a track off of that as well.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll link it. So I really love the final track, Light Sleeper.
That album is mostly improvisations. So I couldn't play it back to you on the piano, you know what I mean? So there were a couple on that album, there's a couple covers, but mostly it was just sitting down and just seeing what comes out. I guess that was the kind of the theme of last year. I'd been like producing so much and playing. I play with an artist named St. Vincent, and it's like, you know, it's a great gig, but we play the same thing all the time. So it's like, I guess that was my departure from, you know, having to be in a constraint, and you know, just to like go in the studio with no plans was challenging, but also fun and cool. And I think those improvisation pieces, they're just like a, you know, that it's a culmination of what I've heard throughout my life, you know, because, nothing was a specific style. I was just kind of playing music.
Yeah. I was reading reviews, you know, listeners had left on Bandcamp, I think, and it was like, this is like Satie, and this is like this. And I personally don't like to do that, but I see why it helps listeners find music as well.
Yeah, because I don't necessarily play a lot of Satie, but you know, of course, when you hear something, it will influence you at some point, so.
And do you do this, do you kind of have a creative practice, especially when you're on tour, just to kind of generate new ideas and get, you know, to sort of refresh your mind?
I do a lot of writing in the hotel rooms, like where I'm at right now. So I think if I mix it up between projects, that keeps it fresh for me. So, you know, John and I are working on some tracks now. So we're doing remote stuff, which is more of a like electronic based stuff. And then I just finished writing like string orchestra arrangements. So, you know, it's like I'm doing different things all the time to keep it interesting.
That's great. Do you have any other touring strategies to keep your mental health?
Working out is a big one. Trying to eat real food is a good one. I just had, you know, microwave oatmeal, so not the best, but try to stay healthy and try to get outside, you know. There's a lot of time spent in a hotel room, so, or on an airplane. So.
You're about to hear Light Sleeper from One by Rachel Eckroff. That album of solo piano improvisations is linked on her website, which you'll find in the show notes of this podcast.
So, John, living in Paris, I'm curious, the jazz scene, I know it's historically been very vibrant there. Has the pandemic affected that, post-pandemic?
I would say it's still pretty vibrant. You know, jazz in general is really celebrated here. That was one of the things that really surprised me when I first started coming over here. It's really, I recently did like a television show where they were celebrating the top jazz artists in France and giving it awards, kind of like the Jazz Grammys or something, you know. So it's just like, it's part of the culture where they, you know, they support the arts, and it's just Is the scene super vibrant? Yeah, it is. But I, lots of times now I just do, I'm not really spending so much time in the smaller clubs like I used to or something. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I play around Europe. You know, I just played in Switzerland last weekend. It's easy, you know, take the train for 3 hours.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so I played a club there. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I travel a lot as well. So
Rachel, I mean, you have a lot of different ways you express yourself musically, including as a singer. And when I was researching you, I found like your early mentor, one of them was Dennis Roland, who is a vocalist with the Count Basie band.
Yeah, yeah. Do you know him or do you know of him?
I don't.
Yeah, so John met him when we were, yeah.
But it's not right, yeah.
He's like a Phoenix mainstay, you know, he's like the man. He's a bit older now, but when I met him, I was about 15. He was, you know, he was already doing his thing out there. He was already big time, and he had toured, I guess, and made records with the Count Basie band at I would say in the 80s. But I won some kind of little scholarship when I was in Phoenix in high school, and part of the, I guess, prize was to go to the monthly jazz society party and go sit in with his band. And so I got to do that. I remember we played Take the A Train. and then after that, he would invite me to come and play at his gigs to sit in. But so my dad would have to take me because I was 15. So he would take me to the clubs. And then I would go play my one or two songs and feel really, you know, happy about it. And it was great. It was great to be able to play with like older professional musicians and, you know, feel what it's like to have to perform on the spot, you know, at that age, because I'd never played in bands before except for high school. So yeah, that's Dennis, and he's still doing it in Phoenix. So.
And you're one of these people who collects vintage keyboards, I believe?
I don't necessarily collect them, but I have them to play. Yeah, so yes, I have a Rhodes Mark V. I have a Wurlitzer 120. You know what? I don't have a ton. I'm not going to say vintage because it's not. I don't have a ton of vintage, but I have a ton of vintage, like, replicas, I guess you could say. So I think that's my only stuff. I have a Yamaha CP70, which is vintage, and that's like an electric grand piano. It's a monster. But yeah, I do. I have like a Prophet and a Mellotron and a couple Moogs, some, you know, all kinds of stuff.
Sounds like a collection.
Yeah, I'm trying to, it is a collection. Yeah, I'm trying to just get like a full palette of colors to be able to work with, so my stuff doesn't always have one sound.
I had Kate Dunton on this podcast, and she was saying how the prices have really gone up for those, and also it's hard to find people to fix them if you can't fix them.
Yeah, that's what I do want to learn how to fix some of my things, because it's a pain in the butt to have to take it. You know, I think the closest guy, I live in Arizona right now, and the closest guy is in LA.
No, I was just curious if that was an issue, because Kate was saying, you know, yeah, you have to find people to fix them. And then I interviewed Pierre Crétin up here in Ottawa, and he said, well, actually, he's been fixing them himself, and like he's kind of, that's sort of a side business for him, is fixing other people's keyboards. So I thought that's pretty smart.
Yeah, it is really smart. I definitely have like replaced Rhodes parts myself before, but that's the extent of what I can do, I think.
Well, John, it was pointed out to me that you were on the Great Nine Horses album Strum, which was featured on this podcast when I interviewed Sarah Caswell. And there's so many incredible layers to that, so I don't know exactly what tracks you're on, but it's such a cool project.
Well, thank you so much. I did all those remotely, actually, in my studio in France.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was a lot of fun. I thought I was just going to do one, but then it worked well, and he sent some more, so Joe did, yeah. I love that album, though.
Yeah, I really
do. Sarah, I've worked with also with David Krakauer, and we did a different project, yeah, called The Big Picture together as well. She's lovely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hi, just a quick break from the episode. I wanted to let you know about some other episodes I've linked directly to this one, which I think may interest you, with Inika Van Dorn, Naomi Moon Siegel, Chuck Kopanus, DeWitt Fleming Jr., and Lisa Pegger. It's a joy to be able to bring these meaningful conversations to you, but this project cost me quite a bit of money and lots of time. Please support this series through either my merchandise store or on my Ko-fi page. You'll find the links in the show notes. For the merch, it features a unique design by artist Steffi Kelly, and you can browse clothes, notebooks, mugs, and more, everything printed on demand. On my Ko-fi page, you can buy me one coffee or every month. You'll also find the links to sign up for my newsletter, where you'll get access to exclusive information about upcoming guests. Finally, if you're finding this episode interesting, please text it to a friend. Thanks.
Let's talk about your recent Drum of Stories.
Yeah, that's the last record that I did. It's on In a Circle Records, which is a record label that Johnny Gandelsman, who just won the MacArthur Award, runs. Like, the catalyst for that was there's a percussionist named Colin Walcott who played in this group Kadona and also another group called Oregon, which are jazz groups from the 70s and 80s, but he was actually killed. He played with Meredith Monk as well, and he was killed on tour with Oregon in Germany. And I've always been a huge fan of his. I even subbed for John Hollenbeck for the Meredith Monk performance once and heard stories about him, so I was really captivated by him. And it turned out that Nana Vasconcelos, the other percussionist in Kadona, and him had a flight case in New York that was abandoned. So his instruments were in there, and so I bought some of those. And so that's kind of inspired the whole Drum of Stories, because it's like I had these drums from both of them and some percussion instruments, and it was just kind of like me imagining, you know, it's like it's an inanimate object, but the stories that these things could tell. I just found it inspiring to actually have it, and to have the case with his name tag with his address on it. You know, it felt kind of special. It's still in the closet. Honestly, it doesn't sound so amazing, but the story is really good.
Yeah.
It's really particular. But yeah, so yeah, I did that. I recorded that in France as well. And it had some people get Ron Blake played on it, a saxophone player, Keenan Osmick, a player that I played with a bunch. So yeah, that's the most recent one.
Yeah, I had a couple of Oregon LPs growing up, actually. I remember band. Yeah. Well, and so you've been exploring electronics with drum. That's like one of your things you've been doing.
Yeah, it's something I like to do. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I mean, it's like I've been exploring, like there's a sampler right here. It's like you can't see the desk, but it's like, yeah, there's a bunch of stuff everywhere. Yeah, that's something I'm fascinated with. I definitely hear a sort of a similarity between, I mean, percussion creates such abstract sounds that making the jump to electronic music just seems like completely normal to me. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and actually Rachel and I both are interested in, you know, sometimes making the acoustic sound electronic, mm-hmm. if you will. So, yeah, so I like to do that and incorporate electronics with that. So it's kind of hard to tell where it starts and ends.
And when you're in lockdown and you couldn't perform with other people, did you kind of get more into that?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I definitely got my home recording, my recording studio situation. Yeah, I spent way more. That's all I did. I think that's what we all did. I did like some you know, video concerts and remote recording sessions and everything. But yeah, but something it's something that really stayed with me, and I still. You know, it's like I'll wake up in the morning and I will always go to my studio if I'm not on tour. Mm-hmm.
And Rachel, you've spent, you know, you mentioned you touring with St. Vincent and some other big artists. Do you remember when everything came crashing to a halt?
Yes, I do. At that time, I was working with Rufus Wainwright still. And a tour was canceled. So that was a bummer. I think after that we did just a few online concerts for like Jimmy Fallon, and we did a Grammys performance that we recorded up on a mountain in the middle of LA, which was pretty cool actually. So that was the extent of that after COVID started. And then, you know, as everyone, I became like a better engineer, and you know, we all did. I think everyone in the world learned how to use a microphone, and you know, so it was a similar thing. I was creating tracks every day, you know, filming myself, doing, you know, collaborating with people online, you know, So it was a good time and a bad time. You know, we all just figured out how to survive, and in that I actually created, I think I made a few records in that span of like a year and a half. Mm-hmm.
And since you're often playing really big spaces now, like, what was the feeling going back to those really big crowds?
Well, at first, when I started up with St. Vincent, we went on tour. You know, we were still masked up, and everything was a COVID test every day, and there was no guests allowed backstage. We couldn't really talk to, you know, we couldn't associate with people outside of our little bubble when we were on tour, because it was like, if anyone got sick, the whole tour would be canceled. So there was that space, you know, that kind of thing. But, you know, going back into large spaces, it's funny because I noticed, like, when I play, you know, in a tiny bar or something, or when I played at Madison Square Garden, in some way it's the same thing. It's like you get into this zone of playing that you don't really, you know, you don't really see how massive or how small the place is. It's just like you're just making music. So, you know, it just becomes the same thing to me. Although it's like really, it's fun to do those big gigs, you know, because they come with nice perks and stuff like that. But it's really, at some point, it's just kind of the same thing. You're just giving music to people, so.
Well, something I found interesting, John, is you had performed with Kenny Werner, the author of Effortless Mastery, which I read along with lots of other people. So did you ever talk to him about the psychological aspect of performing, or were you aware of that aspect of his work?
I mean, I was aware of that. And actually, where I first did meet him was NYU. I was teaching at NYU. He was around. And so we would play occasionally, just because I would hang out at the building a lot. But then a great guitar player, Gilad Hexelman, recommended me to be in one of his bands. And so I was in this group with Kenny, saxophone player Billy Drews, Gilad, and Johannes Weidemuller. And so we would play, but honestly, we would never talk about anything. It was more like the information was transmitted by the act of doing. Which on some level is kind of, it's been a while since I've read the book, but yeah, I mean, that's kind of like, I feel like that was always his sort of, you know, mission statement, if you will, or something. Yeah, it was more like the act of doing. That's where I learned what he was about. You know, he is a lot of fun to improvise with. And especially at that time, it was a while ago. It was a pretty formative period of my sort of development as an improviser. And he was, you know, it's like he gave a lot and you got confidence from that. So it was nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We were talking a little bit before about, like, you know, giving to the audience, and Rachel was saying she didn't feel a difference between small rooms and big rooms. Do you have any performance anxiety, John? Or are you very comfortable?
No, but I would say, listening to that, I was like, wow, she's, I mean, that's great. For me, I would say that I've played some massive venues as well, but, you know, I always kind of had the most profound musical experiences in smaller clubs or smaller venues. I feel like I just always feel a little more, especially if I'm like sweating and like people are like, you know, really close to you, like the intimacy of the whole thing. It's definitely a different type of energy, if you will. Like there's a jazz club that we've played at a couple of times in Germany called Unterfart, and I love to play there. It's also underground and people can be really energetic, and I don't know, that's kind of I've had more sort of profound experiences there than at, say, Carnegie Hall or something. Mm-hmm. No diss on Carnegie Hall, but that's just been my experience.
Yeah, well, it's a different feel.
Yeah.
And Rachel, this is going back a while, but kind of relevant with what's going on now in your country. So you were assistant music director for the Women's March in 2017.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do you want to speak to that experience?
Yeah, sure. You know, I was alongside helping Toshi Reagan do the thing. So she was in charge of all the music. And my job was just to kind of like facilitate some of the rehearsals, and you know, I was the pianist, so there were a lot of cues I had to deal with from artists that got up on stage. But the whole thing, I mean, it was a really cool thing. I had no idea really how massive it was going to be. You know, we showed up in New York and waited, you know, somewhere in Times Square for the bus that we took down to D.C. It was like super cold out. And we went down there and it was very early. And we showed up and a bunch of women playing music, and it was great. It was really cool. You know, I it was fun to have the artists up on stage and you know, all the speakers. A lot of kind of wacky stuff happened there, just in terms of like you know, who was going on stage for how long. Like some speakers would get up and then have to get cut off because they were taking so long. You know, it's just, but it was like the energy of the whole thing was really cool, and you know, I'm all about the movement, and So it was an honor to do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And to be able to use your musical skills to help with activism.
Yeah, I mean, that's about all I've got. So I'm happy to help, you know.
You mentioned when you're on tour, you're writing a lot. So I assume you're writing music, but do you also do other kinds of writing or other kind of creative outlets?
No, not necessarily. I'm doing all kinds of music projects. Occasionally I'll be able to sit down and write lyrics and work on that stuff. I'm sort of not in that frame of mind right now, so I think I'm just kind of living life and waiting for some stories to happen so I can write about them. But right now it's kind of like I'm just working on trying to work on larger scale projects. So orchestra, big band, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. This is a project you did a long time ago, but you were the keyboardist for the short-lived Meredith Vieira show.
Yeah, that was a whole interesting thing doing television. John knows because he did a lot of that too. But you know what? It was a great thing when it happened because I was living in New York and I was kind of having that. You know, a financial crisis, I guess, just being a musician in New York and trying to survive. And I was kind of living on my credit card and it wasn't going well at the time. So I ended up, I did the audition, I got the gig eventually and was able to just get a good footing. And it's really helped. It's funny how that works. It's like, I was able to get on solid ground financially, you know, not to say I was like so loaded or something, but I was not in debt, and that just takes so much off of your chest that you're able to create music and you're able to function, you're able to pay your bills. You know, it really is a big deal, especially in New York when you're just like, you know, so many people are stuck just trying to pay rent and they don't have time to really do their art, you know, and it was great for that purpose. And so in the last 10 years, it's really given me, I guess, a little push to be able to do what I want to do.
This is a clip from Andromeda, from the album Speaking in Tongues.
Did you both feel kind of compelled to go to New York to kind of make it as jazz artists?
Yes. John, you want to answer that?
Yeah, sure. I feel like, I mean, so after UNLV, I went to the Kansas City Conservatory and got a master's degree there. And so I knew when that was over, I was either going to go to LA or to New York. I had a girlfriend in LA at the time, but that became really complicated, so I went to New York. Kind of not joking, but we had another mutual friend, trombone, a wonderful trombone player, who was living in New York with his boyfriend, and they had a closet literally, and that's where I lived. I rented it. There was like enough room for a twin bunk bed, and I put my drums underneath it. It was great. I mean, and then we both worked in a
company. Yeah, that is. That first, I guess, I think it was my first year. It was 2001. I moved there in January 2001, kind of like not knowing a lot of people. But my friend Tia Fuller was going to move, and we were going to be roommates like 6 or 7 months later. So I was just surviving and trying to figure out how to be in New York and meet people and stuff. And then John and I both worked at this little coffee shop in Midtown or Chelsea, I guess. And then Tia moved to Jersey City, and we moved in together. And the next day was when the World Trade Center happened. So she got quite a, you know, shock of moving to New York. But yeah, that was like just a crazy year, you know, and just being, I was 24 when I moved there. So it was just a lot of madness and confusion and good times as well. But
are there things about the city that you've changed your mind about over the years?
I like to say that, I mean, this is true for me, but I like to say that New York, the move to New York is kind of for the young people to go and like learn and you know, make it and just like get your feet in the fire. And there's a certain point where everybody starts going, oh man, I would love to like live somewhere comfortable, you know. And so a lot of us, I think a lot of people move away, you know, when they get into their 40s or whatever. But yeah, I think it's just the need to be there has changed for me.
So John, I wanted to ask you about the Silk Road Ensemble. You've done quite a bit with them.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I'm not sure when that was, but at one point in time I was like Carnegie Hall was offering these fellows. You could be a fellow. And so I auditioned, and it was to be a fellow with the Silk Road Ensemble. And so I went to Tanglewood, participated in that. We did a bunch of new music. And then after that, I started playing as a member, did a couple of projects, did a record, when I played on one of Yo-Yo's records. And I did that for a while. I don't really do it so much anymore, but it was a pretty formative experience. And I have a lot of friends who still do it or have done it. You know, it's sort of this kind of, it's a community.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So any highlights from performing with them?
I played Colbert with Yo-Yo. That was pretty fun. And I was early on it was just like another one of these like, you know, when after that, it gave me a lot of confidence. It felt great. It like was like, okay, this is a really, you know, yeah, just gave me a lot of confidence. Also, he's a really wonderful person. He's really encouraging. He was always just really encouraging to me, and I appreciated that. And the Silk Road Ensemble currently, you could say that the whole concept of it is kind of, I don't want to say it's dated now, but it's changed. You know, it's our perspective has changed. Like white guys playing world music, it's like it's kind of changed. And then we have this other thing where it's like, oh, can you only have, you know, like the politics identity, you know, can you only do only African-Americans play jazz? Do only Indian people play the tabla? Do, you know what I mean? It's like, mm-hmm. It's like, does this have, and I, you know, Yo-Yo once said, you know, he's of Chinese descent, born in Paris, playing a European instrument. So it's like, you know, I feel like this kind of welcoming and approach is, it was grateful and good for me to hear. But I don't really know if I can articulate clearly what I mean about a change, but I definitely feel like it has changed, though, the whole identity of music and what that offers. In the last 10 or 15 years, there's been a shift.
Yeah, I've seen that as well.
Also, look, I benefit from that on some level. As soon when I like moved to France 2 years ago, and people were like, "Oh my God, the jazz drummer from New York is here." I'm like, "But that's me." So it's like all these people, the way you're perceived, you know, it's like I benefit from that sort of identity association now.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know.
So you mentioned there's an upcoming album, like you started working on more stuff together.
Oh, Rachel and I?
Yeah. No,
well, she's nonstop. It's like, no, I'm just kidding. No, we have Speaking in Tongues is coming out on February 28th. I guess it's already been released by the time everybody hears this. And we also have a more electronic based project called The Saints of Paris. And so that's going to be released in 2 weeks.
Okay. So I haven't heard that yet, but it will already be out when this podcast is out.
Yeah, we're kind of, that project is like a side, it's almost a fun project just to have tracks that are streaming, honestly. But we're trying to be creative with it and put stuff out every month. So it's just kind of an ongoing thing.
Consistent making things.
Yeah, I think.
Yeah. It's a little like, it's a little lighter than the Speaking in Tongues.
Yeah, and I think we're, as a duo, we're focused on just getting touring going and doing concerts and stuff like that.
Yeah, we just did our first tour in Arizona, Colorado, and Louisiana. Yeah. That was a lot of fun. And then we will have another, we do some East Coast dates. In March, we'll play at New Blue in Jersey.
It's called the Statuary in Jersey City.
The Statuary. And then in Rizzoli Bookstore.
Yeah, it's the 7th, 8th, and 9th of March. And then we'll have a Europe tour March. In early May.
Yeah. Okay, awesome. I thought it might be fun to leave people. Another really favorite track of mine is Blood Moon. Do you want to speak to the track a little bit?
That one also kind of a bit of like an additive thing. Yeah, we recorded with a bass player that we actually he's amazing and we love him. I love him. He's an amazing musician, Pedro Campanas. But that being said, we also really wanted to make sure that this project was a duo. That was our goal. It was like we both have toured a lot. We did a trio tour also, which was amazing and fun. We really wanted to just have something that was the two of us hop on a train in Europe, keep it simple, not schlepping a ton of stuff. You know, after we recorded the acoustic piano and drums, we did record a ton of synthesizers, which complicated the matter. But the initial goal was just to have like a really transportable project that we enjoyed doing. Mm-hmm. We wanted to make it easy. So when we recorded this, I guess we did use a sort of like electronic bass track. And yeah, it's great. I love this track. Rachel takes a killing solo on it.
It was a song you had written, right? And then we...
Yeah.
What did we do? I mean, we just overdubbed sounds on it, and I played piano on it. And it's really fun to play because it's the time signature increases and then goes back. It's like 3-4-4, 5-4... You tell me.
4-5-6.
Yeah.
So it's that the title really is the sort of reference to like the fact that like Christopher Columbus, you know, in Jamaica, he used like the foretelling. They had an almanac, so he used the foretelling of the time of when the blood moon was to manipulate people, so they would think he had powers. Yeah, because they were shipwrecked and they could not get food or water. And so he wanted to prove that he was, godly. So that's kind of the same reference. Clearly, I'm not a fan of this behavior, but I found it really, I found it a shocking story, honestly. So that's where the title came from.
Okay. Yeah, interesting.
You're about to hear an excerpt from Blood Moon from the album Speaking in Tongues.
Well, such a wonderful project, and so inspiring to meet you both.
Thank you,
Leah, so much for this today.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having us. We really appreciate it. And good luck with all your future podcasts.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please share this with your friends and check out episodes you may have missed at LeahRoseman.com. If you could buy me a coffee to support the series, that would be wonderful. I'm an independent podcaster, and I really do need the help of my listeners. All the links are in the show notes. The podcast theme music was written by Nick Cold. Have a wonderful week.